Hello, this is Gideon Rothstein, and this is a responsible day for the second day of Nisan. Today we're going to talk about some tshuvot of Rosh Hashanah and Arbach. They relate to certain kinds of medical issues. It's from Shutman Chashlobo, Tinyana Bet through Gimel. It's really the second volume of Shutman Chashlobo, but it contains two volumes within that one book, Simon Pei Vav, responsum 86. This responsum, though, is a collection of shorter responsa. It's all in one responsum. It's a collection of shorter responsum, one of which is dated the second of Nisan that we'll get to. It's a very long tshuva, so I actually put the rest of them on the 4th of Cheshvan, which doesn't have a recorded shiur for it yet. But God willing, when I get around to it, the 4th of Cheshvan will be the rest of this tshuva of Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach's. First topic he takes up is the question of who comes first for getting access to a certain medicine or a certain machine. So let's say, for example, you had some kind of a life-saving machine, but you only have one of them and you have two people who need it. What do you do about that, right? That's the question. How do you triage use of medical resources? So the Prima Gadim says that, and this is the background for Shlomo Zalman, that Shlomo Zalman quotes for his tshuva, is that Prima Gadim says that when it comes to assessing whom to treat and how to treat them, so if one person is definitely in life-threatening danger, that's what the doctors say, and another person, we're not sure that their condition is life-threatening, and we only have one medication for the two of them, meaning we only have enough to treat one of them, we treat the one who is definitely in danger of one's life. That's what the Prima Gadim says. We have Vadai Doche HaSafek. The one who is certainly in danger pushes aside the one who is only a Safek in danger. From there, Shlomo Zalman says that that's true about all of these kinds of calculations. The first question is, who is, now, in the Prima Gadim's case, it was a question of definitely in danger versus perhaps in danger, right? Versus it's a Safek. We're not positive they're danger. But Rav Shlomo Zalman here expands that to say that you also have to figure out the level of the danger and the chances for saving them. Meaning, let's say I have two people who are in danger, definitely in life-threatening danger, and one, as far as I can tell, I have a 70% chance of saving, and one I have a 20% chance of saving. Rav Shlomo Zalman is saying that if we can accept the doctor's assessment of that, and then if we have limited resources, we would, if we have not yet invested those resources in one of them, we'll get to that in a second, we could choose to invest in the one we are more likely to save, which means, I guess the best example would be, let's say you had a busload, I'm thinking of MASH, the TV show, because I've wasted so much of my life on TV. I have MASH, the TV, it's not wasted because I'm using it in my Torah study, so maybe, you know, that gives me an opportunity. There's an old Al Franken routine about that, things which are tax deductible, and because he's a comedian, he says everything he uses as an act is tax deductible, and he pulls out, it's an old Saturday Night Live, you might be able to find it online, but he pulls out a TV from behind the desk, he pulls it up, he says, see, this is TV, now that I've used it in my act, it's tax deductible. He holds up a picture, and he has the camera come in, and it's a picture of him on a beach in Hawaii. He says, that whole vacation is now tax deductible. So I often think about things in my life that are Torah deductible, things that on their own don't have any value to them, but if I find a meaningful way to include them and have them fortify and help my Torah study and our this Torah study, that maybe it's not quite such a waste. So in MASH, the Mobile Army Surgical Hospital, or whatever the acronym stands for, they'd have wounded come in on helicopters or on buses. So if you're unloading them, then you triage them, but they triage them one by one. So if you triage them one by one, you say, well, this one is salvageable and one is not, let's say, or this one isn't in any life threatening danger, and they get pushed to the back of the line. I have two people come off the bus who are both in life threatening danger. And Shlomo Zalman is saying, before I've done anything to treat either one of them, if one of them has an 80% chance of being saved, and the other one has it sounds like even just a 60% chance. So it's not, the other one also has a majority chance of being saved, but if I only have limited resources, I invest them in the one who has a better chance of being saved, and he adds, and we don't pay attention to age. And that's an important point, right? You might think, well, if I have a 20-year-old who I could have a 60% chance of saving, and an 80-year-old, with all due respect to 80-year-olds, but an 80-year-old with an 80% chance of saving, I could imagine somebody saying, I can really, really save the 20-year-old, I'm pretty sure that I can, and then he'll have a whole life ahead of him. And hasn't this 80-year-old already had that much of a life? Shouldn't that figure into it? Rosh Shlomo Zalman is saying, no, we don't figure it that way. We only go on the basis of the chances to save them. Now, he doesn't say anything more about it here, but I think it's interesting that he's willing to rely so much on the assessments of doctors in terms of what we think of as the chances of saving people. I could easily have imagined saying, when they say 80% versus 60%, do they really know those numbers? Meaning, if they had said 80% for one and 20% for another, I imagine to myself that signifies a meaningful difference in our confidence that we could save one over the other. But if you came to me and said, the doctors say this person has an 80% chance of living, this person has a 60% chance of living, I would want to know more about that because I don't know that these numbers are always generated in such a scientific, in such an evidence-based way. But that's not in Rosh Hashanah's Tshuva. Then he makes reference to here and somewhere else, I'll only mention it once here, that the Gemara, the Mishnah at the end of Horiot, has a list of who we save first in various situations. And it's a list that bothers many people. I don't need to get into it because he doesn't go through it person by person, but it's a list that bothers many people because it puts people ahead of other people in ways that don't resonate with how we think of it today. And you can look up that Mishnah if you want to on your own. It's not in the Tshuva, so I don't need to do it. But he says, even though, and it's supposed to be in terms of saving people, that would apply here, right? So let's say I had two people. I think he means they both have basically an equal chance of being saved. So then, the person who came first in that Mishnah in Horiot, presumably we should save before the person who comes later in the Mishnah if they have the equal chance of being saved. But he throws in, he says, and that's true of giving tzedakah to them as well, he says, but he thinks it's very difficult to apply such a thing in our times. He doesn't say it shouldn't be, he doesn't say it should be, he just says it's very difficult and he leaves it at that. So I think there's a lot more there that we would want to have a conversation with him about what he meant about it, because I think it's not clear to me whether he meant, I wish we could implement it, or if he meant, maybe we should rethink it. There are going to be other things he's going to talk about rethinking in our times, so it's not like he's going to close to rethinking things. I don't know the answer to that question. Now, all that so far has been talking about where you're deciding where to invest your medical resources, but let's suppose one person is on a breathing apparatus, a sick person, and let's say that sick person in fact has less of a chance of living than somebody else who comes in, right? I have a person who's on a breathing apparatus because, you know, I'm in the hospital on a Monday, person comes in, he has a 20% chance of living. We have a breathing apparatus that will help. We put him on the breathing apparatus. Come Wednesday morning, the ill person is still on that breathing apparatus. If somebody comes in who has an 80% chance of living but needs that breathing apparatus, that's the only one I have, you'd be tempted to say, well, the chance is so much better, we move it. So he says, to move medical equipment from one person to another, either because the second person is in a more serious condition, that's the other way of thinking of it, right? He's in more distress, or is more closer to dying without this equipment, or has better chance of living. So he says, I'm very doubtful of that, because he thinks that once it's gone, been dedicated or given to the first person to use, so that person has already acquired the equipment in some way. It's obviously not his, it's the hospital's, but it's his in the sense that, or hers, in the sense that they've become the person using it. And when somebody is ill, they certainly don't have to pay attention to chances for living, to the odds of living. For example, you have an 80% with an 80% chance of living, a percent chance of living, and they both need the same medication, let's just say aspirin. Right? So, but it happens to be the person with the 20% of chance of living is in possession of the aspirin. Nobody would think that you'd say, oh, we forced him to give it, or her, to give up the aspirin to give to the other person because they have such a much better chance of living. We don't say such a thing. It's crazy. It's his aspirin, her aspirin. They would use it. Obviously, they're punching from giving to the other person. So here too, once somebody is hooked up to a medical apparatus, once it's being used in their care, Shlomo Zalman says that he doesn't see any reason why they would be required to give it up, and therefore, you can't move it. Further step, he thinks also, let's say a doctor has started being involved in that person who has less of a chance of living or who is less in danger of his life, right? Get back to MASH for a second. If you have a doctor who's in the middle of an operation in the MASH hospital and somebody else gets wheeled in who's in either greater distress or has a better chance of living, right? So I, doctor, Hawkeye Pierce, am operating on so-and-so, and it's going poorly, right? I think that I'm going to lose the guy, but I'm not, but I haven't lost him yet, and there's still a chance, whatever it is, that I can keep him going or her going. There was much less, more him because it was soldiers. And then somebody else gets wheeled in it's an operation I can do like this, but unless I do it, they're going to die. Right? So I need to go do it, theoretically. So Russia was from a war, right? Or they have a much better chance of living. Anyway, all those kinds of options. Rishon Zalman says, no, he doesn't think you can. Because we have a halachic principle that we've seen elsewhere as well, that I'll take b'mitzvah, p'ptur min ha-mitzvah. That once somebody is involved in the mitzvah, they don't have to do any other mitzvah. So this doctor, once this doctor has become dedicated and been involved in this patient, this doctor is in the process of the mitzvah of trying to save the life, trying to heal this patient. So then this doctor is patur from all the other mitzvot. And not only that, Shlomo Zalman Orbach says it might be prohibited from leaving the first one for the second one, because he's already involved in the first one. The doctor is already involved in the first patient. So then he adds here, but he wants to be clear that he's not paskining here. He's not ruling, because these are very serious issues. And he doesn't know of clear proof for these questions. So that's an interesting point, right? When he's saying, Oseg Mitzvah, Pater Torah Mitzvah, he thinks that's an idea. He thinks it's a good idea. He thinks it's a meaningful idea, but he doesn't know it. I think the piece about that the sick person doesn't have to give up the piece of equipment, that seems to me like he meant it more seriously, but I'm not sure. And he says all these are very serious issues, and you have to think about them. And he doesn't have absolute proofs of any of them. Now he goes on to another decision. Let's say the hospital were to say, you know what, when somebody reaches a certain level of illness, such that we don't really think we can save them, we don't really think we have good chances of saving them, we're not going to give them certain kinds of medical apparatuses, we're not going to put them on certain kinds of machines, and the reason would be because we only have very few of these machines and we have to worry that other people are going to come in and need those machines. He thinks that's a valid decision. They can make a decision like that. Not only that, he then goes on and says, so this raises a whole bunch of other interesting issues. Let's suppose, take a sidestep for a second, and we'll come back to our question of medical equipment in a second, because the temptation would be, let's suppose I am the, you know, I am related to or a friend of, God forbid, somebody who's seriously ill, and the hospital has decided that they're a trefa, that they are not going to live, that this is not going to work, and therefore the hospital has decided that they can't let them use medical equipment because that medical equipment might become needed for other people coming to the hospital who we can't save. And remember, the hospital is agreeing, once it's hooked up to a person, you can't unhook it to the hospital. So we have to think carefully about to whom we hook it up, because if we hook it up to people and then somebody else comes in, we're going to be whatever. So the instinct of those who are advocating for this person who the hospital has now decided is so ill, there's nothing left to be done, might be, well, I'll steal it and I'll take it for my patient and hook it up to them. And then once it's hooked up, it's a fait accompli. With hooking up machines, that's a little bit hard, but you can imagine in terms of medication. Let's suppose the hospital has a very limited supply of whatever life-saving medication there is. You know, there's that drug that they had for Ebola, but they only had a few of them, and it wasn't clear that they worked, but they had a few of them, but not enough for everybody who might come in with it. So let's suppose that, you know, somebody comes in who's already so stricken by Ebola that this drug we're pretty sure wouldn't work for them. There's a 1 in 100 chance, you know, or even a 500, about a 20% chance that the drug would work for them. 20% sounds like a lot. I would hope the hospital wouldn't necessarily, but let's say hospital says, you know what, you're right, there's a 20% chance that the drug would still work for this patient, but we are pretty confident that later this week people are going to be coming in who have a 80% chance of being helped by this drug. We cannot give this drug to you. So the instinct of relatives or advocates or friends for that ill person might be to steal the drug. And you might say, well, you're not allowed to steal drugs. But the fact is that halakhically we have discussions about these issues. And halakhically the fact is, let's suppose there's a drug. Now we're not talking about issues of shortage. We're talking about the issues of price. Let's suppose there's a drug to the access to which is, you know, too expensive or is beyond, some for some reason, beyond the capabilities of an ill person or the relative of an ill person. So we halakhically think the person can steal it and plan to pay it back later. Right. That's a complicated issue of its own. It's not our topic here. But that's fundamentally the halachic assumption, is that that theft is not, when we say pikuach nefesh doche, it pushes aside lots and lots of things, it pushes aside theft as well. There's probably a requirement to pay it back later, but there can be stealing going on. So you might think, here, I'll steal it. You know, I'll steal the machine and hook up my relative to it, or I'll steal the medication and give it to my relative. Here, Rav Shlomo Zalman thinks you're not allowed to do it. Why are you not allowed to do it? So he says he thinks it's because the only reason why before he said you couldn't disconnect it from the person who really wasn't going to make it and could put to better use, that was only because the machine had already been hooked up to the trefa. But it hasn't been hooked up yet. Rav Shlomo Zalman seems to think, I don't think it's completely clear in the tshuva, so it might be me misinterpreting, but I think what he means is that the hospital has the right to decide they're holding it back for those other people, and then it becomes like it's really belonging to those other people. And to give an analogy, he says, let's say you had two people walking in a desert and they had limited amount, and there wasn't enough food for both of them, and one of them was a trefa. I mean, one of them was going to die soon anyway. So you might have said that the one who wasn't going to die soon anyway, as far as we know, has a better chance of living. The food should go to that person. And that might be, Rav Shlomo Zalman is saying, that might be, in fact, the halacha. So if you had a third person who had enough food for himself or herself and then was also going to give food to one or both of the other people, but was only enough for one of them, you could imagine them saying that's similar to the giving out the medication or giving out the piece of medical equipment. You give it to the one who has a better chance of living. And that's a very hard situation to be in. You would not want to be in that situation. It's very tense. It's very sad. It's very upsetting. And you have to make very hard calculations. All that is true. But it's clearly also true, Rosh Shlomo Zalman says, that if the food was in the possession of the treifa, the food was in the possession of the person who was going to die for some other reason anyway, such that if the food was outside the two of them, we would give it to the person who we don't have any reason to know of a cause of death other than the starvation. But if the treifa is possession of the food, then the treifa gets to keep the food. Same way as if the medical equipment is hooked up to that person already, we don't take it off of them. And in such a situation, nobody would say that you can steal the food from the treifa to save yourself because you're killing the person by the way. So that's what Moshe Feinstein says here as well. He doesn't think you can... I'm sorry, I keep saying Moshe Feinstein, I think because I'm used to doing medical halachos issues with him, but I'm not sure why. Shlomo Zalman Auerbach says... And please go back and listen to the tape, listen to the shiur again. And anytime I said Moshe Feinstein, please put in the words Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. So, Shlomo Zalman Auerbach says, you can't steal... The equipment, he thinks, for similar reasons. Meaning, I think he thinks that when the hospital says that it's going to hold back the equipment because it knows of other patients who will be coming, it doesn't know specifically, but it knows it has good reason to believe other patients will come in who will need that. So then if I take that for my patient who doesn't have enough chance to live, the hospital thought it could legitimately give over the equipment to the use of that patient, then I'm basically stealing it from this other person who's going to come in the near future. And it's here that Shlomo Zalman mentions, again, the idea of the end of the mission in Horios, that he thinks that if you are a third person deciding who to give things out to, when there are equal chances, everything is equal, he does think you should ideally follow the end of the mission in Horios, but he's been told by the person asking the question, and he knows of other people who've hold otherwise, and he's not passing on that issue, but he seems to think that, yes, since it's the mission in Horios, we should follow that. Conversation of its own. So that's the first of this list of tshuvot in this section. The second one is from the second of Nisan of Tufshin Lamed Vav, 1976. So it's good that we get to this, to make sure to get to this before we run out of time. And this is Netinat Tshuvot Hargaah HaGormot Nezek L'Yidiat HaChole. Let's suppose today you have discussions of euthanasia, of like putting people to death because they're in a lot of pain, by virtue of giving them pain relievers, and enough pain relievers that they overdose, basically. Right? Another option for, let's say, people who are in unremitting pain is to put them into medically induced comas, and then just leave them like that, supposedly. You know, just leave them. But there are people who say, well, why should I bother doing that? I'll just let them go. So we don't believe in letting them go on halakha. But here the question is, let's suppose I'll give them things for the pain, I'll give them pain medication, but the pain medication itself will cause some kind of harm to the patient. So it's not going to kill them, it's going to come to some kind of harm. So some, and the question was, can you do it without telling the patient? Can you give the pain medication and not tell the patient the consequences to their health of taking this pain medication? Rosh Zalman Auerbach notes that halachically and in the Gemara, we assume that pain hurts. I don't mean it that way, but we assume the pain is terrible. And the Gemara says that Yisurim or Kashim, that the trials and physical troubles are very difficult for people. And it gives the example. Shlomo Zalman Auerbach refers us to the Gemara that says that there's a case in Tanakh, in the book of Daniel, that about Hanania, Mishael, and Azariah. Hanania, Mishael, and Azariah were three colleagues of Daniel's who were also taken as youths into the palace, into Nebuchadnezzar's court. And at some point, they ran afoul of a ruling of the Nebuchadnezzar's, and the rule was that they were going to be thrown into a furnace if they, for not bowing down to a certain idol. And they said, fine, throw us in the furnace, and then they lucked out, or Hashem saved, they didn't luck out, Hashem saved them for their fidelity to Hashem, and they got saved from the furnace. The Gemara says that if instead of throwing them into a furnace, which is just one act, and then you either get burned up or you don't, if they had tortured them, the Gemara says they think even Hanania, Mishael, and Azariah, but their point is not to denigrate Hanania, Mishael, and Azariah, the point is to make clear how terrible torture is, even Hanania, Mishael, and Azariah would have given in, they think. So according to that, says Rosh Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, then pain is clearly that which we should be taking great account of and being worried about. Important point. And we should have sympathy not only for the ill person's prognosis, but for the pain they're going through under the way, and we should be doing everything we can to try to, everything within reason, and within reason is part of the discussion here, to try to minimize their suffering and to help the pain not bother them. And that's especially true, Shlomo Zalman Auerbach says, because pain also itself can be a reason to hurt their outcomes, right? Because he doesn't get into it, but I think he basically means because the stress and the and the difficulties of dealing with the pain can weaken the patient. That itself can weaken the patient, and make it harder for them for their body to battle back against the illness. And so, therefore, it could be the damage of the pain might be worse than whatever damage we assume and we understand to be happening from the pain medication. So that's his fundamental view, is that we should be giving pain medication. And even if we think the pain medication will cause some downside, there's still room to give the pain medication, because sum total, he thinks it might still be better for the patient. But if the patient is conscious, right? So if the patient's unconscious, we have to make the choices for them. If the patient is conscious, Shlomo Zalman says, I think you have to let the patient know what's going on. If he throws in, im hu bilav hachi yodea matzavo, if he already knows his condition, this is sort of harking you back to a time when medical information was often withheld from patients, and it was thought to be better for the patient not to tell them, because if somebody knew, let's say, God forbid, they had cancer, the fact of the knowledge of cancer was seen as maybe being so distressing to them that it would lead to worse outcomes. So that was a time in medical, you know, in the way the medical profession handled it, and I think that many rabbis might have thought the same thing at the time. So if this person knows his, so if you're going to come to a person and say, listen, you're having all this pain, we want to give you pain medication, but it might cause you this and this and this. So if it's the kind of a person who we are telling them all the things they need to know anyway, and they know everything about their condition, then Rav Shlomo Zalman thinks, yes, we do that. But if not, so that's all the things. So if not, he says, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach says, we have a Gemara in Sanhedrin, Pei Dalet Amud Bet, Rashi, who says, that we are warned against doing to others only against that which we wouldn't want others to do to us. So he's saying if the patient doesn't know what's going on, and this used to come up also, let's say, with elderly parents, and the feeling was that they really couldn't handle their care anymore. I today have met elderly people who really feel themselves they can't handle their care, and they want the handling of their care to be taken over by others. I'm not saying that's the right way to do it. I'm saying that's what I know of happening for other people. So how do we evaluate that then? If we have a person who's not getting it, so Rav Zalman Auerbach's standard is, we should think about what we want in that situation. Now, I think what we want in that situation is probably for others to evaluate what we would want in that situation. So I think what he might be implying is that if in good conscience the people who are functioning for this ill person think that if they were in that situation, they would want the pain medication. And as far as they know this person, they know the person would want the pain medication. Those are hard, hard things to get to figure out, because my experience of watching others do this is that when we try to think for others, it's very hard for us not to think for ourselves. You know, people say, well, I know so-and-so would have wanted X, Y, Z, and then other people involved in the situation will say, no, I know that so-and-so would have wanted X, Y, Z. It's a very hard thing, but for Shlomo Zalman Auerbach's basic standard is, if those who are making the decision are confident that this is what they would have wanted, or that what the ill person would want, then they can do that. In our case, for Shlomo Zalman says, he says pretty much all ill people who are having pain want the pain to stop. And especially if it's serious pain, especially if it's very difficult pain, if you say to them, you know, giving you this pain medication might hurt you a little bit, and they say to themselves, no, no, I want the pain to stop anyway, and I don't care what's going to happen, right? Because the pain itself is so terrible. Pain is bad, right? Pain really hurts, and people want the pain to stop. So if that's true, then we have a very valid assumption that this person would want the pain medication, even if it's going to create some long-term, some damage, either in the short or the long-term. Now, all that, Rav Shlomo Zalman adds, it has to be clear that all that is only to reduce the pain, even if that means... Now, you know, there's you can give pain medication where you say to yourself, I'm giving enough pain medication, it's going to kill him. Basically, you don't say those words out loud because you're not allowed to, but you're thinking that, that's not allowed. But if you say to me, by giving this pain medication, we think that it might hasten the person's passing just because that's the way it works, so that Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach seems to be comfortable with, as long as our intention, we have to be careful, but our intention, as long as our intention is to reduce suffering and to deal with pain, so then he says it becomes like, and then he throws it in parentheses, he doesn't mean this literally halachically, it becomes like a psik resha delo nechale. We have a concept in halacha that sometimes you take an action and it necessarily brings another action. If that necessarily brings another action that we don't want, so many times we're allowed to take it anyway. Meaning, normally on Shabbos, let's say, if I'm going to do something and the thing I'm doing, the action I'm taking doesn't violate Shabbos, but necessarily it will produce another action that does violate Shabbos, so we're generally not allowed to do that. it's called a psik resha. But let's say the other actually produces one that I don't want, so then there are those who hold that it's allowed. That's called psik resha l'nechale. So Rosh Shlomo says as an analogy issue, he says similarly here, if I'm really focused and my concern is helping the person's pain, I don't have to worry about what it will do to their health. But it's only because I'm focused on that. Then he adds that also that we have a principle in the Gemara in a bunch of places. There are actions which they can seem very dangerous, but because people tend to do them, so if in our case people tend to take this pain medication and that's what they do, the Gemara says v'ha'idna shomer p'tayim Hashem, that we are allowed to rely on the verse that says that Hashem takes care of people, to say that if something that people tend to do, that's not considered suicide, it's not considered kill yourself, it's considered taking a dangerous action, but it's the kind of a dangerous action that people tend to do, and therefore it's permitted to do so. So since many, many ill people tend to take pain medication and they run the risks of it because they so much want the pain to go away, that Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach seems to say should be okay. And then he has a discussion of plastic surgery. He says, in plastic surgery, if your point is not a question of superficial beauty, you're not doing it to look better, but you're doing it, let's say, because your current looks are so different than other people's looks that it's really embarrassing and it's really very difficult for you to go around and to function, that's like a moment, becomes like a real blemish on a person, and his whole point is just that people shouldn't like stare at him or her. People shouldn't notice him or her. So he thinks that's all right. But if it's only for the purpose of looking better, right? So let's say there's a tshuva, right, you see, I saw many, many years ago, where he allowed a married woman with children to have a nose job. And I was very surprised by it, because I would have thought that a married woman with children, she has a life, she's already put together a life. There was no indication of the tshuva that her husband had any problem with her looks. And yet, Yosef allowed her to do it. So I think that Rosh Shlomo Zalman here gives us reason to understand why that would be, because if the nose job was about, she just wants to look better, that would be awesome. But if the nose job was, she spent her whole life walking around thinking that every time she walks through a room, people look at her and see, oh, look at that nose. So that would be the room to say that she's allowed to do that. That's Rosh Shlomo Zalman's short response about plastic surgery. The standard should be that if it's to remove something that the person feels very, very uncomfortable with, not a question of creating greater beauty, that should be allowed. You know, I chopped up this tshuva into two, as I mentioned at the beginning, and I'm running out of room on the pieces that I selected, so we might have to leave some of it out, and so that the other chashva won't have all of the other pieces of it, but we'll see what we can do. So the next piece is about spending money to save somebody who's ill. So the Gemara in Sanhedrin, Ayin Gimel, and Aleph, seems to say that you have to do everything you can to save somebody else. Otherwise, it's a violation of the prohibition of lo ta'amot al dam re'acha. You can't stand by and watch your brother bend over your brother's blood, right? So that's a prohibition in the Torah against allowing others to die unnecessarily. He throws in parentheses that obviously after the cure was done, the person who had been ill would have to pay back the debts thus accrued. So this gets to the question of how much money you have to spend to keep the Torah. There is a general principle that when it comes to positive commitments, to obligations, we don't have to spend more than a fifth of our money or a tenth, depends on the thing, but that certainly you'd have to pay. But if you think it is a prohibition, then to avoid prohibition, we generally seem to pay all the money that there is. So Shlomo Zalman says he thinks that is relevant to this question, and it's odd to him that people know of other people who need the money and need care, and we don't throw all our money at it. But then he said, he's not interested in posking this issue, but he says it could be that once the public in general knows about it, it doesn't become a personal obligation. I mean, let's say I'm walking by, this example he gives, I'm walking by a river and somebody's drowning in the river, so then I'd have to do everything I can to save that person because I'm the person on the spot with the ability to save that person. But once it becomes an issue of, let's say, sadly, somebody has an illness that we have every reason to think it was going to kill them, it's very expensive, but that becomes the obligation of everybody to put in, and then I don't have to put all of my money into it. But fundamentally, he thinks these standards should apply. That's a whole conversation of its own that we don't have time to get into, but that's the first thing to think about, and the question of what are our obligations to others in terms of spending money. And it's also true that sometimes we think if we only spend a lot of money, we'll save them, and it ends up not being true. And then you get into questions of how much do you have to spend to save people for a temporary period of time, meaning the saving that we're going to do is going to extend their life a month. So is that lo tamor adam riecha? It's true that we can violate Shabbos to save that person's life, even though it's only for a month, a day, or a minute. But how much money do I have to spend on that? So Shlomo Zalman is getting to those issues. Those would be issues that come up in this same discussion. The last piece that we were supposed to get to, they're not going to get to fully, so I'll just do it very, very briefly, is a question of how you determine the moment of death, and what how that does or doesn't reflect on the question of taking body parts. Rosh Shlomo Zalman is very clear that he thinks that that if a body part from a person who's passed away could be used to save somebody's life, then he thinks it's clear that you have to do it, and he doesn't even seem to think that the disagreement of the relatives should matter. That's and he says that because what's the point, what's the value of burying it? You're going to bury it 6 feet under the ground when it can be used to save somebody's life. How can you not do that? That's his impression. The problem is, though, that how do you know when the person has passed away? So there's lots of examples of that, but one of the sharp examples that he gives is, sadly, let's suppose, and there's a Tshuva Chasam Sofer already talking about this, is let's suppose a woman passes away in childbirth. So the baby's still inside. Right, so at what point are we allowed to cut open the mother to get to the baby and maybe save the baby's life? That's a very hard question, because once the mother is in life distress and maybe being killed, then we have limited options for what we can do to her, because by doing those things, we might be killing her, and we're not allowed to kill her, even if she's about to die. Right, the halacha is a gosis. If a person is on their deathbed, they're dying, we're not allowed to do anything to hasten that death. You're not allowed to close their eyes, meaning we think they're dead already, but you're not allowed to close their eyes, or just about dead. Can't close their eyes because you can't touch them. Basically, you can't touch them because that might hasten their death. We're not allowed to do such a thing. We're not allowed to hasten their death. So with this mother, even though if she was alive and going to live, we could do a C-section. We could cut her open because then we could sew her back up and she'd recover. A woman who's dying, we have much fewer. That's a harder call to make, because our doing what ordinarily counts as a C-section might itself hasten be a cause of her death. That might save her life too. So that would be a question for doctors to discuss. I'm not saying it definitely does that, but it becomes a complicated question about saving the life. So too, in terms of taking body parts for other people that are going to save other lives, you need to know exactly when the moment of death is. So Shlomo Zalman says it's very clear that in halacha, the moment of death is the cessation of breathing. Problem is, cessation of breathing is very hard to establish, because people at the end of their lives can sometimes go a long period of time without any breath and then breathe again by a long period of time. I don't know, but I think there are cases where people didn't notice any breathing. There are cases all the time of people, not all the time, but there are cases periodically of people who were buried alive and for whatever reason was discovered. And there may have been people who were buried alive and was never discovered, and they eventually died because they suffocated in this. So, but in order to get there, it means that there can be people who, for all apparent purposes, are not breathing anymore, but they really were breathing. So that becomes a very hard thing. And Shlomo Zalman here says he thinks that the better that the medical profession is at figuring these things out, the more we can rely on those things. And we don't have to go just by whether we see breathing or not, because if we have better ways of doing it, obviously those better ways of doing it should be used. So that's a very brief summary of that last piece of it. But this is a responsive day for the second Nisan, the beginnings of Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach on various medical issues that came his way, especially the one from the second of Nisan itself, the question of giving medication, pain medication, that might harm a person. Secondly, Senator Shlomo Zalman Auerbach on issues of saving lives, when we do and when we don't. Have a great day.